the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. That voice you heard, that lovely, soothing voice, was Sarita singing Sunny, accompanied by the incomparable Joe Pass Trio, who also accompanied Ella Fitzgerald in some of her greatest albums. And the other voice you heard was that, of course, of one of the greatest singers in history, one of the greatest pop singers in history, and actually a social force for decades, and that was Francis Albert Sinatra, the night he hosted The Tonight Show. And fortunately, I was the first guest that he had on. If you're ever curious to see the stand-up that I did for Francis, you just Google John Barber and The Tonight Show. And there it is. Well, here we are in John Barber's world, 5 p.m. on a Monday here in Las Vegas, Nevada. And, you know, years ago we had history's historic October surprise. And now we are just 6 days past the historic November surprise, perfectly described by Jim Nabors as surprise, 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 proving once again in America any billionaire can grow up to become president without ever having to grow up. Trump's big victory, folks, was not over Hillary. It was over the corrupt media. And I must tell you, the documentary that we're going to be screening in Dallas on November 21st, The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, with Jim Garrison telling the rest of his story about how some in the media were complicit in setting up the murder of John Kennedy and how the others protected him. That documentary is extremely prophetic, because since Trump entered the race, even folks now who don't care at all about politics, which is now more than two-thirds of all Americans because we had such two dreadful candidates, they wake up every day to stories about how corrupt the media is and was. And that was a major contribution by Trump entering the race. And this film, with the help of Jim Garrison, traces the history of how, when, where, and why it became so corrupt. But I assure you, now that he's president, you will hear little from them about the habit that he shared with Hillary, which was female crotch grabbing. Because Nixon said years ago, and he proved it in his interview with David Frost, when he said, "When the president does it, it's not a crime." When we discovered President Billy Clinton's Ted Bundy-like side as a serial rapist, the media treated it like it was a hobby. I would like to say a lot more about Trump's first two words when he heard he'd won. "You're kidding!" And I have. You can read and comment on them on my Facebook page. Right now, though, I'd like you to meet a lady and author at whose JFK conference in Dallas on November 19th. I will have the pleasure of speaking, where 2 years ago the folks had the pleasure of listening to me. And maybe that's why she invited me back. Well, 5 years ago, I read her very readable book, Lee and Me, the Lee being Lee Harvey Oswald. Regardless of one's opinions about the veracity of her amazing story, as a book, it is a terrific read. A love story, a mystery story, an extremely historic story, and a very important one. The author who wrote it and who lived it, Judith Very Baker. Judith, welcome to the show.
Hello. And yeah, the name of the book is Me and Lee. I didn't do that. That's a grammatical error, and you corrected it. The publisher did that to us. really, a lot has come out since the book was written, and more witnesses, and we're going to have them at the November conference coming up, where you will be speaking.
Well, first of all, it is not a great connection we have, so I imagine you're hiding in a bunker somewhere. Can you give us any idea where you might be talking from?
I'm talking from a bunker.
Well, let me tell you, I want to congratulate you on assembling a really terrific round of speakers. One that I'm really anxious to find out what he has to say, I mean, aside from myself, is Dr. Cyril Wett, who I'm so anxious to meet him. I mean, when I was putting together the documentary, I had to acquire a lot of documentation, and I wrote to him and his secretary, Flo, a number of times. They gave me the greatest material, and he was the very first medical person to stand up to CBS and the Warren Commission's Saturday Night Live single bullet theory. And so I've been an admirer of his for years and years and years. Now, you brought up the business of your book and your book cover. I'm going to ask you, until you brought it up, I never even thought about it. But who designed the book cover?
I hesitate to tell you because I would not have done it like that.
Well, what would you have done? Because I'll tell you what I would have done, but I'll listen to you first because the inside is terrific. So
Well, it is a unique design, but nobody in a Christian bookstore will put it on on the shelves because of it.
Why wouldn't they? Because of the picture of this attractive brunette on the front sticking her chest out in the French Quarter?
With the bars and everything in the background there, 500 Club, which is a strip club. So it looks like it's the story of a stripper or something.
Okay, could I ask you? Do you have a favorite picture of you and Lee?
Well, no, we had no photos. I mean, we're both married. We're working on a project that was absolutely crucial to kill Castro. We're not going to be seen together. However, I saved all kinds of documents to show that we were. For example, Lee and I moved into the same neighborhood, only blocks away from each other the same week. We arrived in New Orleans the same week. We rode for 11 weeks on the same magazine bus. That bus is mainly filled with black people.
Oh, Judith, I must tell you. Listen, You don't have to convince you of that. I have no doubt of that. First of all, I want to get into the cancer thing in a minute, but I'm going to tell you this. I loved the book, okay? But if I didn't know much about this, I don't know who you are. It said there's a pretty brunette on the front. I don't know who Lee is. But Lee is obviously Lee Harvey Oswald. A picture of Lee.
You can't tell Harvey from the cover. I would have just done it differently.
Yeah, well, I would have put a picture of Lee on it, for crying out loud. Then I know it would have sold. I mean, I'm sure it's doing very well anyway, but it would have sold.
Well, I beg to have the cover changed, but they won't do it. And that's just the way it is. Originally, the name of the book was Innocent Blood, the story of Lee Harvey Oswald and Judith Baker, his girlfriend.
Oh, how interesting. Okay, now, Judith, let me get back to the business of when you were a young girl. Tell us just a little bit about your background, your family, your siblings, and how on earth you got so interested in science, and how on earth could a young woman, you couldn't have been more than 15 or 16 or 17, find a way to accelerate cancer in mice? I mean, that is just beyond me.
Okay.
So start from there.
I don't have much time. They said only like 35 minutes. I've never had such a short interview with so much to say. But basically, John, it's like this. When I was a little girl, my father was taking me to Chicago with him. By the time I was 8 years old, my father was inventing parts for and components for color TV and for regular TVs with a man called Adler in Chicago, who was famous for helping to invent the remote control. And he was working with WGN. And they were the first to put out color TV broadcasts from Chicago. My father implemented that. He earned so much money on patents that actually Adler took out. It's sort of like Edison. You know, Thomas Edison had all kinds of people working for him. My father was able to retire and move us to Florida when I was just a little 11 years old. I built my first TV set when I was 8 years old. And,
wow.
He never had a son, and I went with him everywhere. I learned everything. So, I mean, science was in my blood right from the beginning. Now, by the time my grandmother died, I was very concerned. At that time, I was deep into chemistry, and I went to the International Science Fair from a project that I developed when I was 16, which is a new modified way to get magnesium out of seawater that was so interesting to Dow Chemical Company. They at the International Science Fair, they bought it, the patent rights for $500. The way it went, John, is like this. He said, she's a minor, now we'll offer you $500 and we'll just take it.
Oh, my God. How did it happen?
My grandmother died of cancer, and when I was at the International Fair with this, I also was surrounded by all kinds of people like CIA. Across from me was Robert Strum, who won the $64,000 question, for example. I was playing chess with him there. And we got a lot of attention because of Robert Strum, so pretty soon I found myself surrounded by this who were interested in Strum. And who, by the way, went on to be a fantastic genius over at IBM. And the upshot of it was, as they saw my cancer research work that I was doing, and I was at the time 16, and all kinds of offers came in for help. To make a long story short, I had also a mentor, Colonel Philip Doyle, at Manatee High, and he had all these retired military officers. So I was hooked up here with Walter Reed Institute for Research, and over at Oak Ridge, two of my doctors that worked with me were both trained the year before at Oak Ridge with the CIA. CIA was all over this. And I have a lot of newspaper articles to make to shorten this narrative. By the time I was 17, I was giving mice cancer. I wanted to give them cancer so I could cure cancer. So I was trying to do it the fastest way possible. By the time two Nobel Prize winners, that's Sir Robert Robinson and Dr. Harold Urey, both of them Nobel Prize winners, came with Dr. Dio, who was the head of the American Cancer Society's, all of their research, and Dr. George Moore came, and Dr. Alton Oxner. All three of those were very famous people because they'd gone around claiming that cigarette smoking could cause cancer, but they didn't have that much definitive proof. They would come out the next year with it. When they saw what I had done, I had given mice cancer, lung cancer, in only 7 days. They closed down they closed down the lab because it was dangerous and because the virus was involved with that. And I was taught to handle viruses, cancer-causing viruses, then that summer. And I got world-class training for up to almost 2 years.
How did you end up in New Orleans? Now,
Dr. Oxner involved in the project on his own. Very anti-communist, anti-Castro. Had lots of support. Was flying every week to Washington D.C. So you have this background. He is working on a project with Dr. Mary Sherman, and this involves David Ferry, but also others, to weaponize cancer. Because he's in the newspaper saying that doctors need to get involved in the Cold War.
Okay, Judith, let me just ask you a quick question. You said to weaponize cancer. Now, we look back and we can see that. But I would doubt, you know, there were 5,000 people involved in the Manhattan Project to build the atom bomb. And probably only 8 people knew what the bomb was going to be about. Did you know? How soon did you know that they were weaponizing it, or did they give you the impression you were creating a cure for cancer?
John, I came in early. I came in too early, and they thought I was someone that was being brought in to help David Ferry, and that was a girl. He was a homosexual, and they thought they made a mistake. My doctors were out of town. I came in 2 weeks early to the project, and I ended up on the secret side of it.
Oh.
So they gave me a lot of information. It was too late. But I had also dated like Tony Lopez. This guy, there was CIA. I had all this CIA stuff all over me, and they just made a mistake. By the time the doctors came back, it was too late, and they had to tell me what was going on. And so I got involved in the project that way.
And you were aware at how old were you when you were aware 19, that they were weaponizing it?
19, and it wasn't very long. If you look in the book, Me and Lee, you'll see that they're telling me things right away due to a series of circumstances, such as I could speak some Russian. They just thought I was more trained and more involved than I really was. So basically what we're looking at is a girl who's only 19, but they're bringing in an asset that has no tags attached. I'm not a doctor that you can't get.
And what were your thoughts?
A special formula, John, from Roswell Park that became the RPMI 1640 formula. I could grow cancer faster than anybody else. And it's in the newspapers that I was trained to make cancer grow more deadly. More deadly. Now, I thought I was being trained to do that in order to help conquer cancer. But actually, they were grooming me all along to work on weaponizing cancer.
Now, you're 19 years of age, and you tell us that Osler, as we all know now, was a rabid anti-communist.
Yes.
What were your impressions of him as a 19-year-old when you heard this guy sprouting the things that he was sprouting about anti-communism?
Well, wait a minute. I came from Florida. I mean, 6 months earlier, Castro was aiming nuclear weapons at us. I was all for it. Besides, he was he was so famous. And he had so much prestige. I mean, it's like God telling me what to do. I mean, we really, at that time, remember, we believed and trusted our government. We believed and trusted our authority figures. And so
even Jim Garrison said, you know, he believed his government. Why would he doubt it? He was a military man. He said he always followed orders.
That you're doing a favor for your country, you might be able to save the country from World War III. So, I mean...
Now, you mentioned this fellow who was a homosexual. Was David Ferry a homosexual?
Oh, my goodness. That's like asking Santa Claus had a beard. Yes,
okay,
sir.
Then listen. When Jim Garrison arrested Clay Shaw, he ordered his staff never to mention the fact that Clay Shaw was a raving homosexual who was into S&M. Okay, now. Lee Harvey Oswald is hanging around with Clay Shaw and David Ferry. Was he homosexual?
No. Yes. Well, wait a minute. He's also hanging around with a lot of people who are not homosexual. Here's the problem with homosexuals in New Orleans, and it's important. Homosexuals were able to be blackmailed, so you could get information out of them. That's very important to understand. Also, we have police records showing that they deliberately shaved Lee's pubic areas after when he was arrested. So-called getting samples. They, I mean, humiliated him. And then Hoover was able to say he was a homosexual. They would push this homosexual thing so that way it would hide the fact that he had a girlfriend. It'd hide the fact that, he had a wife with two children already? The fact that he's notorious for being a lover with the Japanese women in Atsugi. It's just ridiculous. Remember, we were pro-civil rights. We didn't
okay,
believe
now,
about,
you,
yeah,
you,
so, I mean,
you,
that
you
was
meet
part
him,
of being pro-civil
you,
rights.
Okay, Judith, you meet him accidentally in a post office.
Okay, yes.
Tell us that story.
Well, everybody asked about that. Basically, what happened is I got there 2 weeks early because of a misunderstanding. I wasn't going to go home. I didn't have enough money. So I got a very short part-time job, I mean, 2 hours a day just to pay for the YWCA where I was staying until the doctors got back, because they didn't have a record that I was coming, and I didn't want to go back. I had a fiancé I thought I was going to marry. It was sex. It wasn't love. I didn't know the difference at that time. He was supposed to be writing letters to me of love every day, and he wasn't. And here he says...
Was that Robert?
That was Robert, and we now believe he had Asperger's, and that's why it was like... So Robert written, And I'm only allowed to, because we were eloping, because his parents were anti-Catholic, I had to send a letter that looked like it was from one of his friends. It wasn't from me, from New Orleans. And also I put an ad in the paper because I wasn't allowed to make a long-distance call to him because his parents wouldn't let him go to New Orleans. He was trying to find a way to get away from his parents because they were going to have him work all summer with them. So he wasn't able to come right away. And I had to come right away because, of course, I was going to be on this project. I didn't want him to know that I'd be staying there. I did tell him I was never coming back to the University of Florida. So he said, well, then I'm going to come and marry you. And I was going to New Orleans. But he had to find a way to get there. Okay, so the letter I have written to him, it shows at R. Rourke as the return address at General Delivery in New Orleans. So that's I was using his friend's name. and general delivery. And it was being sent to R.A. Baker at Eglin Air Force Base. Now, why? His parents were working at Eglin, building residences for military officers there. So here's the thing, though. Lee Oswald is standing behind me, and we now believe he was sent to protect me because when I first came to New Orleans, and I wasn't on the list, and my doctors were out of town, they put me in. I got in the cheapest room I could, and that was with two strippers, a Playboy bunny, and a hard waitress. Yeah. Well, the first thing they did is they said, "Honey, you don't know anything. We're going to show you the town."
Okay, boy, Judith, hang on a second. Okay, I'm going to fast forward just a bit. You fall in love with Lee Harvey Oswald. It's a very intense and very sincere love story. I loved reading about it in the book. Now, I have two questions for you. The first question would be, did you know that he was hanging around people like David Ferry and Clay Shaw? And did you ever say to him, "Lee, why are you hanging around homosexuals?" Okay. Or did he say, did he ever confide in you that he was working for intelligence and was assigned to hang around them?
Yes, and it's all in the book.
Yes, I know, yeah. But I want you to tell me
the story. Of course, people don't know. All right, like, we have to go back again to the post office where we left off, because Lee sees these things, and he knows that there's a Robert Baker at Eglin Air Force Base who's FBI. He knows that this man Rourke is a friend of his, a CIA pilot, and associated with Jeffrey Sullivan. He thinks, "I am in right away with the whole group that he's working in, this anti-Castro, that's against Castro, and they're putting him up as pro-Castro and all that." He tells me things he should not, because he was asked, David Ferry was going to be gone a lot. He couldn't be involved as much as he thought, and they were trying to find a helper. Now, because I was a girl, they thought since David Ferry was a homosexual, that they sent this girl to help. It turned out that Mary Sherman, David Ferry were close. I was working with Mary Sherman. Lee Oswald hears that I am associated with Mary Sherman, and then she is in this project with David Ferry. So he tells David Ferry, and right away I meet him. And Lee tells me, "Listen, he's a homosexual. Don't let that get to you." Open-minded about that. Well, he said, "So am I. I don't care." He said, "I can get information." So right from the beginning, if you read in the book, you'll see that I was introduced almost from the beginning because they thought I was someone else, the person they had asked to bring in to help David Ferry with the project. And it was a girl because he was homosexual and he couldn't seduce me as a girl.
Okay, so when he said to you, Judith, "I could get information," did you ever say to him, "Why do you need to get information?"
Well, of course, we had a lot of conversations almost immediately. You see, I only started this relationship with him because he didn't have a wedding ring on his right hand. I mean, on his left hand. It was on the right hand, which is what they do overseas if you're in the USSR or Hungary or somewhere like that. So I had started flirting because I was angry at my fiancé hadn't written, and I was still not married. I didn't have to marry him. And so that's how the conversation got started, and the fact that I dropped the newspaper that had this code in it. He picked it up, sees this code, but I answered him. I thanked him in Russian. And he replied in Russian, "My God, who in the world in New Orleans knew Russian? This is how did the code work?"
How interesting. So
this is how it all started.
I'm going to leapfrog forward a bit because you're so interesting and you have such a great story to tell. One of the questions I need to ask you about this business of accelerated cancer that kills people.
Yes.
Do you think that these are the things that might have killed Bill Hicks or Marley or Hugo Chavez?
I, of course, was not present there. I can only conjecture. But knowing that we had this available back in 1963, it was attested, and that we had the church committee showing Frank Church and the others is showing them deliver a shot that can either murder you by a heart attack or by cancer.
That's cancer, exactly right. Yes.
Probability is high.
It's in our film. It's in our film. Okay,
good.
Now the other thing, let's move on to the assassination. Jim Garrison, by the way, he did tell us that Lee Harvey Oswald was planning on divorcing Marina.
Absolutely. And, you know, John, we have this agent. coming to Laredo, Texas. They go through the two banks. They're all through their safety deposit boxes. They go through, rummage through all the lockers in the bus stations, because Lee left his suit there. You'll not, which you can see photographs of him in his suit. You won't see his nice clothes in their possessions of Lee Oswald, because he left those. So because we were going to meet in Mexico again, we were going to get married, we were going to get quickie divorces, just like Jane Mansfield did.
Okay, now, Jim Garrison wrote The Star-Spangled Conspiracy. It was his fictitious narrative of what he believed was a very true story, that Lee Harvey Oswald was Central Intelligence. He was only debriefed by the CIA when he came back from the Soviet Union, which verifies that, and that he was assigned, in order to be set up, he was assigned by his handlers. They were telling him that he was going to infiltrate a group that was planning on murdering the president.
That's the case.
Now tell me, as much as you know, that he actually told you, or did he keep that quiet, and did you discover that after death? And then the next question is...
It's in the book, fully. I need you to tell me this.
You keep saying, I know it's in the book, that's why I'm asking, so that people will hear the story. When he's arrested, he makes a phone call, I believe, to Carolina. Who did he call?
He's trying to call a cutout there, and he was making a call to a cutout who could reach his handlers, because he needed help.
And that was his death warrant. Garrison said that was his death warrant, because he's never supposed
to believe,
do that.
Yeah. But on the other hand, he was told,
okay,
he was
hold
told
it a
to
second.
Do that, John.
Hold it a second. Did he know Richard K. Snagel?
He knew of him.
Richard K. Snagel thought
that if they didn't
kill Oswald, as the Pats say, they were going to kill him. And so he ended up in El Paso, Texas, and shot a gun off in a bank. And when they arrested him, he said, I don't want to be in Dallas on November 22nd. What do you think Lee knew about November 22nd?
All right. From the very beginning, Lee Oswald knows that he's playing a deadly game here. He knows that he's not being allowed to advance in the company. That is, he was trained by the ONI, who was borrowed by the CIA. They're not letting him advance forward because James Jesus Angleton, who was his handler upon his return, didn't trust him because he didn't come back in the coffin. That's what Lee told me. They're going to send him to college.
How about David Atlee Phillips? He's identified at the House Select Committee by a witness who said this is the Maurice Bishop that used to meet with Lee. So it was not. Tell me about the relationship that Lee, did Lee ever mention this guy?
Had met, this man had called himself Mr. B originally. Then he said his name. It's interesting that he used two variations of B name, Bishop once, and then another time he used a different name starting with B, and Lee realized that he was had forgotten which name he was using with him, and that wasn't his real name. He was eventually able to find out that he lived in Fort Worth, and he really figured out that this was David Atlee Phillips. He saw some photographs of Phillips, and this is the man he met. And by the way, Antonio Veciana was there when David Atlee Phillips met and talked with Lee. Veciana was there when he approached, and Lee was there. He came out with a statement. It is absolutely, in fact, he wrote the note to Fonzie, who was HSCA investigator. He said, that man, he said this just before he died, he wrote the letter, that man was David Atlee Phillips. And Lee told me the same thing. And I put that out in 1999. Veciana didn't say that this was the case until a couple of years ago, in 2013.
Did Lee ever tell you that he had to go to Dallas and look for a job, or did he tell you that he was assigned and given a job?
This job was assigned and given to him, and in fact, this is why Roy truly, he says, when they say the policeman came up and Roy said, oh, this man is working, for me, as if that would not be someone who would be a suspect. The reason he said that actually what he left out is he was told that Lee was working for the FBI. That's why they let him go right away. That's what he actually said. He lied and just said, oh, he's working for me. Because anybody working in that building could have been a suspect anyway. That would not have been enough. But the fact is that Lee was an FBI informant. That's what he was told.
So they let it go. Did Lee ever tell you that he knew Tippett? And I'll tell you very quickly, Jim Garrison felt that Tippett was killed by one of the gunmen at the Grassy Knoll, and the purpose for the murder of Tippett was that everybody hates a cop killer, and they Garrison said they hoped that when word got out that Lee Harvey Oswald shot a cop, that they would shoot him on sight, and that it was a mistake that McDonald got to him first in the theater. Now, in the theater, why do you think Lee fought back?
I can tell you, I wish we had more time. But the fact is, McDonald made an error. Remember, these police got together as to what they said actually occurred there. Lee had his hands in the air, remember?
Yes.
When McDonald approached, and McDonald said, when I reached for his belt, that's what he said, that's when Lee hit him. Now, here's the background for this. We have an interview that McDonald made sometime after his original official interviews, where he said, I approached Oswald with my gun drawn. Now, think about that. He's got the gun in his hand.
Right.
He says he approached him, and then as he reached for his belt, that's when he got hit. Now, what did he do? Did he holster the gun and then Lee Oswald? No. We believe that he was trying to plant the gun on Lee Oswald. This gun was safe. The gun was made so it couldn't even shoot.
Wow.
You know. Yeah. So then they could say, and that gun had already fired at least a round or two, so they could match it to Tippett. See, that's what they were trying to do. But actually, that didn't happen because the gun had a bore. And Johnny, if you know anything about it, the bore is big enough, like it was in this snub-nosed Wesson Smith & Wesson 38. No bullet coming out of it. Two bullets would match, and that was useful too. It was also the preferred weapon for the Dallas Police Department at that time.
What was your very, very, very last conversation with Lee, Judith? And after you answer that, tell me what you think is the most important evidence that has surfaced in the last 50 years about Lee or John Kennedy or Garrison or the case. First of all, tell us your last conversation. Your last conversation with Lee.
It was only 37 and a half hours before the assassination. And Lee even asked me to pray for him. I was an atheist. He didn't even believe in God hardly at all himself. He was agnostic. But foxholes, don't hold atheists. And he cried.
Right.
That's the way it was. He said, this is important.
Judith. If he's asking you to pray for him, he must think something's going to go wrong.
Yes, because he said he was going to die. They were going to kill him. But he had stuck it out because he was able to get information. He said at that time that, and I told this in 1990.
Oh, hold on. If they're going to kill him, are they going to kill him because he's a patsy?
Here's what happened, John.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to let you answer, but I'm going to ask you one more question. Listen to me. If he had a gun, why did he not fire off warning shots?
Oh, God. Let me start. John, wait. Stop. All right.
Okay.
Because when when Lee,
You have time, dear. Go ahead. Your last conversation with Lee and why thought he was going to die.
Because he had sent a telex on Sunday, and then he said he was under suspicion. That telex has the word like assassinate, and instead of assassinate, they say it came from Hoover. It did not. It came from him. He said, I believe I saved, and before that, he said, I believe I saved Kennedy's life 3 weeks ago, almost 3 weeks ago. Now, when I told that in 1999, nobody believed me, but since then, we've had Abraham Bolden come out saying that a man named Lee warned the FBI in Chicago, and they arrested men, and Kennedy's life was saved there.
Hang on just a second.
He's under suspicion.
Okay. What happened in Chicago is that a motel owner happened to stumble into a room where there were two Cubans with guns and a street map of the route. And he called the cops. And the cops never arrested these two people. And when Abraham Bolden tried to tell this story to the Warren Commission, they put him in prison for 6 years.
No, this is not quite what happened. The Secret Service that Abraham Bolden was with in Chicago.
Right.
The FBI called them and told them stand down because they had obtained information. They arrested several men. They did let some of them go. And Dali was apparently the patsy in this thing. They said the Secret Service, Abraham Bolden was there, stand down, that Kennedy is not coming to Chicago. He's not coming because of the plots. They're still working on all of the situations. So it was called off. And Lee told me that was 3 weeks before the assassination, just what Lee had told me. When I talked about this in 1999, Abraham Bolden's story hadn't come out to the public yet.
I see. Okay. Now, so your I'm last saying,
Now, Lee, all right, now here's the thing. Lee Oswald in a situation now where David Ferry, this is very important, David Ferry told everybody that he hated Kennedy. That's because he'd been training pilots and so on. They got hurt or killed at the Bay of Pigs. And he was standing before a conclave of retired generals and all kinds of retired military officers. Their first meeting, they had David Ferry, a talented speaker and genius. He was their keynote speaker. First time they met, he was their number one speaker. He gets up there. He's angry about the Bay of Pigs material. He says Kennedy ought to be shot. Somebody's going to kill him, you know, shooting him from behind a bush. They made him get off the stage. And John, then, as soon as the meeting was over, they came around him and said, look, we feel the same way. We can use somebody like you. You're a talented pilot. You speak fluent Spanish. And you go back and forth with your plane all the time.
And that's in your book
New
about
Orleans
Ferry.
And Dallas.
David Ferry
later learned that it wasn't Kennedy's fault. But now he was pretending that he hated Kennedy. He got a lot of information. He and Lee Oswald were indeed friends. He was able to pass on some of that information to Lee. And that's how Lee got involved, and he was probably led into it, just like Garrison said. And by the time he knew that he couldn't get out of it. But he did do his best to try to save Kennedy's life, and I love him with all my heart, and that's why I'm fighting for him. I could have become a rich woman, John, all I had to do, because I've got all the witnesses, people who saw me.
I must tell you, honestly,
Judith, Lee Oswald killed Kennedy.
Listen to me, Angel. I must tell you, there are a lot of people who doubt your story, and I am not one of them, and I'll tell you why and how I answer them. And I know a dear friend of mine, Leno Sandick, did a wonderful three-hour interview with you, found you fascinating, never quite aired the story because he just, you know, he said there are no pictures of her. It seems to me if you're in love with somebody, you're going to have some secret pictures, even in one of those 25-cent machines. Now listen to me. And I'm telling you, the reason I say I believe you is because I tell them no one in middle age is going to risk the calumny and the hatred of their government, the contempt of their fellow citizens, or the disenfranchisement from their family by fabricating such a story. There has to be a mountain of truth to this. So that's why I believe your story, and I don't mean to be harsh on you at all because I am strong supporter of yours, and I wish we could talk for hours. But what I want you to say, you're going to have to say goodbye until I see you in Dallas. Where can people get your book? And most importantly, what is the most important thing you have to say right now that has come out in support of your love, Lee Harvey Oswald, whom we all know didn't do it? So go ahead.
I suppose the most important is that in 2003, after 28 hours of filming, I said that Lee Oswald called the operation to kill Kennedy the big event. Now, St. John Hunt calls me mom. We've gotten so close. St. John Hunt had his father a deathbed confession only several years after I said Lee called it the big event. St. John Hunt's father comes out. He says he was involved. He was involved. And he said the name of the operation was called The Big Event. That's one of my biggest ways
That's true. And, you know, and when when Hunt made the blunder of suing Spotlight because Marchetti said that he was the bagman that delivered the money, and he lost that case, and the whole world did not hear about that. And that, I must tell you, I do believe the son. I do believe the son about the confession of his father, but I do not believe the father. He said he was a bench warmer. He was not a bench warmer.
Well, yeah, but he knew the name of the operation. He called
yes,
it a big event.
Yes, he did. And he was a major player and not a bench warmer. Anyway, Judith, I want to thank you. Where can people get your book? Where can they get
okay.
the very book?
Well,
tell
if they want autographs, they can go to judithvarybaker@gmail.com. That's J-U-D-Y-T-H. V as in Victor, A-R-Y, Baker at gmail.com. And I'll tell them how to get an autograph book from me. Otherwise, they can go to Amazon, or they can go to Trine Days, and they can order from Barnes & Noble. Every time they try to put them in Barnes & Noble, they get stolen, so you have to order it.
And I presume that your conference has been long sold out.
It's been sold out for a month, John.
Well, I must tell you, I'm really looking forward to seeing you again. I loved meeting you a couple of years ago, and even more so now, so that if you think that I've been a little harsh on you tonight, I have not been harsh on you. I'll make up with a big hug, and I hope you like what I have to say, and I hope I know what I have to say when I get there. Judith, thank you so very, very much. We'll be right back, folks, with the most interesting, the most articulate newsman in America, my cohort, the creator of News Vandal, Joe Satilli. We'll be right back.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Thank you for that smile upon your face. Oh, sunny.
This is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
At last.
Well, beyond the sea.
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Live.
Thank you so much. I want to thank George Knapp for that wonderful unsolicited plug on behalf of The Last Word on the Assassination, which is still doing amazingly well on Amazon, and the funds that we earn from that have been going into this very last enterprise, which will probably, I expect, will be the godfather of documentaries when it comes to Jim Garrison and the assassination. It's called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. We're going to have one screening only, one only, prior to a major release of some sort, either in film or on alternative media somehow. But that screening will be 1 o'clock Monday, November 21st, in Dallas, Texas, at the Texas Theater, where they arrested. I'd like to welcome now to the show my best friend here ever, and the most interesting man I ever talked to, Joe Satilli. Joe, welcome aboard again.
How you doing, John? I got to tell you, I am totally exhausted. I just can't wait for this election to be over. Whoa, what's so funny?
That's so funny.
Wait, you mean it's over? Did I miss it? Did I miss something?
Yeah. You mean I won? No kidding.
Oh.
That is so funny. That is so funny. Anyway, how are you?
Well, I do have to say that I am exhausted. It was quite a week last week. It's been nonstop. Doing the rundown has been crazy. Just the flood of information. On the flip side, this is just about the most interesting time to be a journalist and to be a journalist covering politics. I mean, this is absolutely fascinating. The shock that has been sent, and then the aftermath of the shock, which is that gleaming gold-plated Trump plane watching it get hijacked by neocons and lobbyists in the GOP establishment, is just about one of the funniest things I've seen in politics in a long time.
Well, you are absolutely right. It is an enormously interesting time. You know, you could paraphrase the line from A Tale of Two Cities, the best of times and the worst of times. But it is. It's going to be monumentally interesting. It may be, it'll be new, but it may also be corrupt in a new way that we haven't yet witnessed. But let me ask you a question. I have never heard this name before until I saw it on your rundown, this Steve Bannon.
Yes.
B-A-N-N-O-N. Who is he, and where is he? Where does he come from, and why on earth did you write about him?
Well, he has a military history. He went to Hollywood to try to make some movies. He was a Goldman Sachs banker. And then after Andrew Breitbart passed on, he moved in and basically took over Breitbart and changed it from kind of a semi, almost neocon-y, but sort of interventionist, pro-Bush, hard right but not alt right website into the alt right conduit into Republican politics. And when we talk about the alt right, it's a collection of things. You know, Alex Jones is alt right. You would have sort of the anti globalists and maybe even people who are anti Illuminati. But a lot of the alt right are so called white nationalists. That's the rebrand from white supremacists. These are people who would like to have white America kind of come back and reassert itself and be dominant. There are some people inside the alt-right movement, some of the leaders of the alt-right movement, who would actually like to convince all non-whites to just leave America because racial mixing is not fruitful for either, for any races.
This guy Bannon has articulated such?
No, he has given a platform to this. So this is the complicated part of this. You know, sometimes you wonder if some of these guys, like Alex Jones, I don't know that he believes one half of what he's saying. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But I could tell you this. He sells a lot of product on InfoWars. I mean, he sells boner pills and T-shirts and water filters and doomsday prepping, you know, kits. So there's a lot of money to be made in this. Now, there's gonna be a lot of scrutiny here over the course of the next few days. There's no doubt that he is in the same kind of vein as Nigel Farage of the UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, that then led the Brexit. And Bannon is actually opening up branches of Breitbart now in Europe because he would like to spread this kind of anti-globalist, populist upswell.
How close is he to Trump?
He is apparently... Now, it's interesting. In terms of political commentators, I find all of the interesting political commentators are the ones who used to be Republicans, because for some reason they actually kind of tell you something, whereas the Democrats, talking heads, they never tell you anything. So
no, they're hiding and blaming somebody else.
Yeah. So this guy Michael Steele, who was the first African American chair of the RNC, and has a lot of connections in the RNC, says that Bannon has the ear of Trump above anybody. Now, Reince Priebus. Doesn't Reince Priebus sound like sort of a luxury car from Yugoslavia or something?
It does.
I'm driving my Reince Priebus over. So anyway, so Reince Priebus is chief of staff, which is normally the number one position among all staffers in the White House. But Steve Bannon has been given a position of chief advisor, and Trump said that they will be equals, which is unprecedented.
If Trump gives that job to Bannon, then he must have known and trusted Bannon for a long, long time.
Well, look, Bannon and Kellyanne Conway saved his campaign. And
wow.
getting rid of Paul Manafort, and one of the reasons why Paul Manafort left, in addition to the fact that the political Kardashian family didn't like him, all the kids didn't like him, and the campaign was obviously not going anywhere because Manafort basically said the campaign is Trump, and I don't think that Manafort did a lot to try and cajole or convince Trump. What Bannon and Kellyanne Conway did when they came in is started to get him disciplined, and by the time Trump got on the teleprompter, it was kind of spelling doom for Hillary, because the way the campaign went is whoever was in the news was losing.
Yeah, but I think the thing that turned it around for Trump was not Trump or Bannon. It was Hillary Clinton calling Trump supporters repulsive.
The deplorables. And you know what's
funny? The deplorables. I mean,
her staffers say that when she came off stage, she immediately said, "I really blew it, didn't I?" I mean, she knew when she said it that she had done it. That was part of it. There are so many things. The other thing about this campaign, and let me finish one thing on Bannon. I think my favorite thing about Bannon is that before we came on air, I was watching Glenn Beck denounce Bannon as a terrifying and malignant human being. So,
were you
on the wrong side of Glenn Beck as being
you
a little bit wacky?
Beck found somebody lower.
So, were you being denounced? You know, it's like you never want Dick Cheney to say, "I think you're heartless." So, you know, it's one of those moments. On the other side, I like politics on a number of levels, and one way I do enjoy politics is on the same level that I enjoy baseball statistics. I like seeing, should you have thrown a curveball in a 3-2 count in the ninth inning with two men on? I like that stuff.
Okay.
And one of the interesting things about the Clinton campaign and the utter and complete disaster of the campaign, which is coming out now, because, you know, once you lose, all the knives come out. I think my favorite thing I read was that Bill Clinton, who... I'm not talking about policy. This is just like, can Bill Clinton run the 100-yard dash kind of assessment? Probably the most gifted politician I've ever seen in my lifetime. I mean, his ability to communicate and to convince people in spite of their self-interest to vote for him. I mean, he's just magical in his political gifts, not his policies.
You know, he's exactly like Reagan in that respect.
Yes, yes, just like Reagan. So he apparently spent the entire campaign going to Brooklyn and talking to Hillary's team and saying, you know, you got to go to the Rust Belt. You got to talk to these people. You got to feel their pain. And they kept saying, "Oh, Bill, you don't know what you're talking about. Oh, Bill, go home." By the end of the campaign, the final 6 weeks, Bill Clinton created his own mini campaign outside of the official campaign and was going to those places that she was ignoring where she lost the election. She never went to Wisconsin one time.
Wow.
And the utter arrogance of believing that you could just take for granted that Macomb County in Wisconsin, excuse me, in Michigan and the Milwaukee counties in Wisconsin, and that Pennsylvania would just automatically go for you. Mm-hmm. Just the hubris of that, I find infinitely fascinating and slightly hilarious.
Well, you know, most Americans are so glad that Wisconsin's so far away. and most Americans, I must tell you, I met a number of really rabid Trump supporters, okay? But for the most part, most of the people I know who seem to be reasonable and compassionate, they are not pro-Trump. They're just thrilled that it's not Hillary.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, and the funny thing is about it, John, with all of that, Trump was such a flawed candidate that he won with a million less votes than Romney had. And that to me is the staggering, you know, for people, I know a lot of people are, you know, they're looking for their exit plan to Canada and they're, you know, thinking about maybe we should all do like a ritual suicide, like a cult or something. Yeah. Just to, what I want them to realize is that if you look at the numbers, it's not that America has gone off the rails into something. It's that Hillary Clinton's campaign so completely bungled the easiest gimme in American politics.
Yeah, and you know, I got a funny note on my Facebook page. I get a lot of funny notes, but this guy has some very funny ones. He said, you know, that she got the popular vote, and she said, and he said, it's a guy, his name is Anthony, and he said, and he got most of the veterans, and he got every veteran from the, she got every veteran to vote from the Civil War in Chicago.
You know, well, it's something else, but I'm going to tell you this. For all the people who thought that they're now not the people who just were voting against Hillary, but people who actually thought that Trump was going to drain the swamp and that Trump was going to, people better be careful what you wish for, because what he is, the people who are populating, I mean, his choice now for Secretary of State is coming down between the neocon, John Bolton, a man who believes we should have been
bombing
Iran 5 years ago.
The Bush guy.
Oh, no, this is a guy that William Kristol looks up to. So,
oh, my goodness.
You got John Bolton or Giuliani. Rudolph, can you imagine sending Rudolph Giuliani around?
The only picture I see of Giuliani is a 911 and he's running from one of the buildings, building 7, that it's going to come down. How does he know it's going to come down?
Yeah.
I mean, oh my God.
And look at the stocks that have gone up in the immediate aftermath. Private prisons skyrocketed.
Right.
Coal, Peabody Coal was in bankruptcy. Nope, it's up 50%. Defense stocks through the roof, including Raytheon. Banking stocks, because now they realize that Trump is going to have inflationary
yeah,
policy.
But, and you know what Chris Hedges says? He is so glad that Trump got elected. He said, because this is the beginning of the end of empire. He says, they're just, the people will accept anything now except the corruption. They know they'd rather have the unknown, and the end of the empire is upon us. And he's thrilled about it.
Well, I, you know, before the election, when people asked me, I said, if you're looking for a reason to vote for Trump, it's because you'd like to strap a suicide bomber's vest onto a politician and send them into D.C. Now, that's what I thought. What is shaping up, unfortunately, is that he is being normalized and accepted and co-opted by the GOP establishment at a breakneck pace. And there is... I think that there is every chance that this may just become, you know, the Reagan years 2.0.
Well, Joe, I must tell you, I'm so glad you're here. There's so much to go into. Somebody just sent me a note about the guy that's going to be a Secretary of Treasury is a skull and bones man from
Munchen. He's a big banker, Stephen Munchen.
Well, anyway, tell folks where they can hear you again. And how they can get a hold of the News Vandal, which is just wonderful.
Well, just tune in here in 2 weeks, and John and I will talk again. And you can actually tune into the Ocelli Effect this week, tomorrow for me for an hour. And then on Thursday, John will be there talking about the movie. I guess I'm going to join in just to be Punch and Judy. But tune into the Ocelli Effect on Thursday at 5 o'clock Pacific to hear all about the Garrison Tapes Part Two, and then just go to newsvandal.com, and you can sign up for the rundown.
Joe, thank you very, very much. Thank you all. Thank you, Don Newsom, for being our engineer, and thanks again to Mike for being our brilliant, brilliant producer, without whom I would not do this show. Thank you all for listening. Good night.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny. I love you.